we live by.
The National Broadcasting Company and its affiliated independent stations make free time available to present the Eternal Light summer series, The Words We Live By, a transcribed program which comes to you under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. Today we present another in this series of informal and unrehearsed discussions of selected passages from the Bible. And now we take pleasure in introducing our moderator, Professor Judah Golden of the University of Iowa. Professor Golden.
For today's informal meeting on the words we live by, as we take up another biblical selection for discussion, we've invited Cantor Robert Siegel to join our regular participant, Professor Abraham Halkin of the College of the City of New York. And our special guest is the Distinguished Consul General of Israel in New York, the Honorable Arthur Lurie. The passage out of which the present discussion is to grow is in the last chapter of 2 Kings, where we read of the event which is commemorated by the day of fasting, called in Hebrew Tisha B'Av, that is, the ninth day in the month of Av. We'll begin with a selection of the chapter read by our announcer, Bill Malcolm.
Now in the fifth month, on the seventh day of the month, came Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, a servant of the king of Babylon, unto Jerusalem. And he burnt the house of the Lord and the king's house and all the houses of Jerusalem with fire. And all the army of the Chaldeans that were with the captain of the guard broke down the walls of Jerusalem round about. And the residue of the people that were left in the city, and those that fell away to the king of Babylon, and the residue of the multitude, did the captain of the guard carry away captive. And the pillars of brass that were in the house of the Lord, and the bases and the brazen sea that were in the house of the Lord, did the Chaldeans break in pieces, and carried the brass of them to Babylon. So Judah was carried away captive out of his land.
Thank you very much, Bill Malcolm.
Mr. Golden.
Yes, Mr. Lurie.
I must say, listening to that passage, which refers to events which I suppose took place about 2,500 years ago, they seem to have a very special interest and relevance to present-day events, to events that happened in the course of the last year or two in Israel.
Cantor Siegel?
Well, now, would you say that the recent experience in Israel is a close parallel to the events referred to in this passage?
Well, I think the one best equipped, really, to answer questions of this sort would be Mr. Halkin.
Well, there certainly is a similarity between the sufferings under the most recent siege of Jerusalem and the siege which the city withstood at the time of its fall. But as far as the history of the period goes, 3 years before the fall of Jerusalem and the conquest of Judah, she had been a vassal state under the Babylonians, and in her desperate effort to regain her independence, she waged a struggle which was sure to be a futile one when she rebelled against the Babylonian Empire. And after a siege of some 3 years, the city of Jerusalem fell in 586, and the land of Judah became part of the Babylonian Empire.
This 586 is, of course, before the regular calendar,
yes, of
is
course.
It not? But, of course, this day, the ninth day of the month of Av, which we use as the date for the destruction of the first temple, is also the date of the destruction of the second temple.
Yes, well, that happened considerably later. That was at the time when, once again, Palestine was a vassal state, this time under the Romans. In the year 67 of the Common Era, the land of Judah rebelled against Rome, again out of a desire to become independent, and again after a futile struggle. In the year 70, Jerusalem was captured and the state destroyed for good.
Isn't the date also associated with other calamities in Jewish history? The expulsion of the Jews from Spain was also reputed at any rate to be to have taken place on the same date.
Mr. Halkin.
Yes, according to tradition, it's a signal day for calamities. The Jewish tradition counts five calamities which are all supposed to have occurred on that day. It was on Tisha B'Av, according to tradition, that God punished the Israelites in the desert by telling them that they would never reach the Holy Land. It was on that day that the first and second temples were destroyed, as already mentioned. Similarly, the Bar Kokhba rebellion of the year 135, when another attempt was made to free the people, failed, That too happened in the year on the day of Tisha B'Av, and according to tradition again, the Roman Emperor Hadrian plowed up the city of Jerusalem on the day of Tisha B'Av.
You have referred, Dr. Halkin, to tradition in this matter, and I suppose it's not really important whether it's scientifically accurate or not, whether it happened on that day. What is important is that in Jewish tradition and life, Tisha B'Av is bound up with the idea of tragedy, of the destruction of Jewish life in Palestine, and later, of course, of the calamities of the dispersion.
Yes, scientifically, I doubt that the dates could all be proved, but what you say is, of course, correct. It's just the day with which we like to link all of the disasters and catastrophes that the Jewish people has suffered in its history.
It hasn't yet been formally linked in that way, but I suppose one might very properly link the latest and perhaps in some ways greatest calamity which has affected the Jewish people, the destruction of the great Jewish communities of Central and Eastern Europe, also with the idea of Tisha B'Av.
Well, I suppose when we commemorate all that Jews have suffered through the ages on Tisha B'Av, we think of the Holocaust of the 6 million Jews in Europe just as well.
I think the way in which the day, Tisha B'Av, this ninth day of the month of Av, is celebrated in the synagogue captures the spirit of this folk tradition. In the synagogue itself, for example, there are no lights. The ark either has its cover removed or it's covered with a black cloth. Pious Jews, for example, are in the habit of walking barefoot. They sit on the floors as they recite the passages that are associated with the day. And specifically, of course, the Book of Lamentations is read at that particular time. This book, which is said to have been composed by the prophet Jeremiah, the prophet who saw the actual destruction of the temple, in some ways, I think even in its melody, would capture the mood which has come to dominate this season of the year. Cantor Siegel.
Well, yes, the lamentation mood, or mode as it is called, definitely gives a feeling of great anguish and distress and sorrow, aside of the fact that the words too, the words naturally convey the actual happenings. But the lamentation melody is peculiar to lamentation, and it's not used for any other part in our literature, or in the prayers, or in the Pentateuch, or the prophets.
Yes, that's of course true, but what makes you say, for example, that the melody also captures the mood? I know the melody, and everybody around the table, of course, knows it, but what is it that makes you say that the melody, the quality of the melody, is one that makes it lugubrious, very sad, and conveys a sense of tragedy?
Well, it's not the melody alone, but a combination of melody and the words. I would like to chant the opening passage of the Eicha to express that much
very
than
good.
I could in words. Eicha yashva vodot hoi rabos yom hoyesok yalmono rabosi bagoyim sorosi bamedinos hoyeso loma.
Maybe you can tell me something, Cantor Siegel, that's always puzzled me. I've heard this melody, of course, every year in the synagogue. And the words, how doth the city sit solitary that was full of people? How has she become as a widow? She that was great among the nations and princess among the provinces, how has she become tributary? Now, these words, how well do they fit with the melody itself? Would you say that there is a connection that a musicologist would easily see between the melody and these words?
Well, these particular words seem to be wedded to the music which is employed. But music, of course, grows with the words. You become accustomed to it, as you have to become accustomed to the actual sound of the music itself. For instance, I'd like to point out the melody that is used for the reading of the Torah. And if you would hear any other melody, you would feel that it is incorrect.
You mean that there is a distinct difference, not only that one hears, but that one can appreciate between the chant that's used on Tisha B'Av and the one that's used on, let us say, an ordinary Saturday morning, Sabbath morning, for the reading from the Pentateuch and from
the reading of the prophets. Also, are from the reading of the book of Esther, the book of Ruth. There's a definite melody. Now, I would like to... I won't use text from it. I'll merely use the names of the neumes, or the markings, which give each group of notes identity. On the Sabbath morning, when the Pentateuch is read, we use the following melody. Mapach pashto zokeif koton, merchoti pcho munaches nachto, daregot evir, merchoti pcho sof posuk. Naturally, the sof posuk is the cadence, resolving it. And to carry this a little further, the prophetic portion, which accompanies every Sabbath reading, uses similar names for the neumes, except that the melody is somewhat different.
Well, the names of the notes are always the same, are they not?
It's just the names, while they're not translatable as such, are indications. In the olden days, the Mapach Pashto or Segol, which the director of the singers would indicate to either lengthen the note or to waver the note, to quiver or to speed up or to conclude. So Pasuk, which they all have, is the cadence, the actual resolution of the sentence.
Well, what would you say makes, let us say, the cantillation of Lamentations more sad than the cantillation of a prophetic portion?
Merely the combination of the text, number one, then the mode, which, of course, is the combination of notes. Modes are groups of notes which indicate certain mood. And you use that particular, these particular intervals, which make for sadness, rather than for the more major quality of the Pentateuch.
Since you introduced the text, Cantosiegel, as a factor in feeling the sadness of the music, does it follow that a person who doesn't know the text and simply listen to the music wouldn't be impressed with it as one who does?
That is a very, very controversial question, whether music is objective or subjective. However, I believe that music is objective, and the text which you give to it gives it the color either of sadness or of joy. But in this particular instance, perhaps I've heard it all my life, and I can't imagine... The fact is that these notes are notes in themselves. They were called lamentation notes for the simple reason that they convey a lament.
You mean if a person who did not know, for example, the text, simply heard these notes as you chanted them for Lamentations, he would feel sad, and if he heard the Saturday morning reading of the Torah, of the five books of Moses, he would not get a feeling of sadness?
He would feel that something is being declaimed, more of an imperative tone.
I see. You would call that really exclamatory
more,
or didactic?
Yes, that's right, as compared to the lamentation. Whereas when you hear the lamentation, even though you do not understand the text, you still feel a certain longing, a certain sadness, which are melancholy sadness, of tragedy, which the music itself implies, at least to me it does, because I have been accustomed to hearing it only with Eicha. I don't feel that this way when I hear the prophetic portion, which is Ma pach pashto zokei koton mechot ipcho munach esnachto dargo. This is merely a narrative theme which tells a story. And if you notice also in the even the prophetic portion, we do have, for certain specific portions, we do have a different chant, which is more closely related to the Eicha, or the lamentation chant.
Mr. Halkin,
is there any relation, Cantosiegel, between the chant used for reciting Lamentations and the chant used in the synagogue on Tisha B'Av for reciting the various elegies and prayers which have been composed over the generations?
Yes, the Eicha is definitely accepted as the lamentation mode. However, as time went on, the more recent composers, of course, over a period of 2,500 years, there have been many, many additions and many thoughts added, both musically and in text. There has been some music added which has not been universally accepted. Are many chants which are in the minor mode, which have been accepted universally, and you will find in a Tisha B'Av service that pretty much throughout the service the same theme repeats over and over again with different text.
Mr. Lurie, I've heard it said that in many of the synagogues, for example, in Israel, one could hear a variety of chants. The customs, in addition to the chants, often different depending upon the origin of the Jews who've come to Israel, since this has been the gathering of the exiles?
Well, in Israel, just as in any other country where Jews pray, you will find that there are religious and non-religious Jews. And among the religious, there are a great many varieties of religious custom which have developed in the course of the centuries, whether among the Sephardim or among the Western Jews, the Ashkenazim. And I should imagine that Professor Halkin can tell us more about that, actually, than I can, because while I can probably describe something about our attitude in Israel towards Tisha B'Av today, I'm afraid that my own knowledge of synagogue customs is not as intimate as it might be.
Before you go on to this, Mr. Lurie, I wonder whether you could tell me whether it is possible to observe Tisha B'Av in the old city of Jerusalem, which is held by the Arabs.
No, I think that is one of the additional occasions for lamentation and wailing today, because for what is perhaps the first time in 2,000 years, there are no Jews in the old city following the end of the fighting with the Arab armies. And of the 28 synagogues that existed in the old city, not one stands today. They're all in ruins.
They've all been demolished,
They were all demolished, either in the fighting or even after it.
Well, are there any Jews, for example, in the old city?
There's not one Jew today.
There is not one Jew left in the old city.
It's, of course, part of the agreement which we hope one day to reach with the Arab countries, that there shall be access to our holy places, which include the Wailing Wall and the site of the temple.
Mr. Siegel.
No, I wanted to ask, Mr. Lurie, whether the Jews have any access to any part of Jerusalem, the old Jerusalem at the present, and he has already answered that.
Well, that really takes on a new significance to think of Tisha B'Av, the ninth day of Av, in modern Israel. One hears so often that now that the state has been reestablished, why even bother recalling the fast day? And as soon as one mentions that in this holy city, the capital of the state of Israel, 28 cities, synagogues, I beg your pardon, have been demolished and Jews can't get access to the holy places, I suppose that must give people the feeling that the significance of Tisha B'Av has not altogether disappeared.
Well, actually, there were questions put to the chief rabbi. Questions came from rather varied sources. One came from the chief rabbi in Algiers, and, the rabbi of Constantine. And another came from Turkey, asking him whether, in view of the establishment of the state, there was any change in regard to the observance of Tisha B'Av. And the rabbinate, chief rabbinate, replied quite categorically in these words: the ninth of Av commemorates Tisha B'Av, commemorates the destruction of the temple. Therefore, it has not been abolished.
I see.
The fast continues unchanged.
Mr. Halkin.
It's interesting that in history, too, we have a record of a rabbi who lived a short time after the fall of Jerusalem to the Romans, who suggested that the fast day of Tisha B'Av be abandoned. And as a matter of fact, we have in the Bible an account from which it seems that during the time when the Second Temple was in existence, they apparently did not observe the day of the memorial day for the fall of the First Temple.
Yes, I was just about to make a reference to that. I gather that appears in the writings of Maimonides, that the Tisha B'Av was observed even during the time when the Second Temple was standing.
Yes, but from the Bible, it is just as possible to conclude that the facts were not so, and that there was no observance of Tisha B'Av during the Second Commonwealth.
He was quite a prominent rabbi, was he not, that rabbi of the second century who wanted to see this day, the observance of the day abolished, and he did not succeed despite his prominence
and
his position.
Yes, he was a very prominent rabbi, and just as at present we find all sorts of excuses for retaining the day of mourning, so then undoubtedly a great many of his colleagues felt that there was too much to remember to give up the day.
Of course, I think that Tisha B'Av has another and very important aspect besides that purely of mourning. It looks not only to the past, but also to the future, the idea of the restoration. It may be a restoration in a symbolic rather than a literal sense, but from that point of view, it has been a constant source of inspiration. And I would say that Zionism which has been so vital a force in Jewish life in the past two or three generations, has derived from the tragedy of Tisha B'Av some of its strongest and most constructive inspiration.
Mr. Halkin,
the tendency to seek comfort and find comfort even on the day of Tisha B'Av is again very, very old. We have a wonderful story relating how four rabbis walked up to the Temple Mount after it was destroyed, saw it in ruins, and saw jackals running through it. Three of those rabbis began crying. The fourth one, on the other hand, Rabbi Akiva, began to laugh. And when in dismay they asked him why he laughs, his answer was that when catastrophe reached this zenith, relief was bound to come. And that we can take comfort in the very ruin, because after this, a change for the better must appear.
Well, that illustrates, if I may just interrupt Cantor Siegel for a moment. I mean, that really illustrates the point which I was making, which is that in Tisha B'Av, one has implicit this idea of the urge to rebuild the life of the Jewish people and its restoration to its one-time independence.
Cantor Siegel.
No, I merely wanted to ask Mr. Lurie that the Kosel Hamaravi, the Western Wall, the Wailing Wall, which had been the place of meeting for on Tisha B'Av, wasn't it? It was a very prominent place where Jews would go to recite the Kinnat. Has that been replaced with another spot? I read somewhere that King David's tomb has been now accepted as a shrine for such observances.
Yes, it's, I suppose, normal to seek comfort in some other shrine. What has happened, actually, is that outside the walls on Mount Zion, there is perhaps a shrine or building, if one might call it that, which embodies in itself the traditions and beliefs not only of Judaism, but also of Christianity and of the Muslim faith. Because on the upper floor of this building, there is the cenacle, where the Last Supper was supposed to have been celebrated. On the lower floor is the Tomb of David, revered as such both by Jews and Muslims.
And do all groups of people come there? In other words, do Jews, Muslims, and Christians
at
all
congregate?
At different times,
yes. Jews have begun to come there since the old city has been closed in increasing numbers, and it has become one of the main holy places of our people in Palestine, in Israel today.
You're saying that it's natural for people to look for some place or for some means for comfort. And Mr. Halkin's telling the story about Rabbi Akiva inevitably brought to my mind the story that is also told about the locale of the temple site. After the destruction of the temple, we're told that a famous rabbi by the name of Yochanan ben Zakkai was once walking in the streets of Jerusalem with his disciple Joshua ben Hananiah. They got to the place where the temple had formerly stood, and when Joshua ben Hananiah saw the ruins of the temple, he began to weep. Then his master said to him, "Why do you weep, my child?" And he said, "How shall I not weep when I see the place which was formerly Israel's splendor and the place through which Israel's sins were atoned, now lying in waste?" And Yochanan ben Zakkai replied to him, "Do not weep, my child. We have a means of atonement today as effective as this. And what is it? It is deeds of loving kindness." And he quoted the verse from Hosea, "For I desire mercy and not sacrifice." Apparently in every age then, as you say very properly, there's been a consciousness of the calamities associated with this occasion, and yet there has been a sort of stubborn unwillingness to be overwhelmed by the calamities, either by means of finding a new location where one can express his grief, or by means of reinterpretation, so that you get a new insight into the significance of the institution which has been destroyed, and you translate or transvaluate, I might say, almost old values. Mr. Halkin.
I should like to add that, in my view, this is really the great contribution of the modern movement to reestablish the state of Israel, that instead of just resigning and sitting back and mourning, a number of leaders realized that the only way to change the situation was to take things into one's hands and to begin doing. It's expressed in literature. We have a wonderful little essay by a modern Hebrew thinker, Ahad Ha'am, who visited the Wailing Wall, saw people mourning,
and expressed the thought then, if a land is destroyed, it can be rebuilt. But when a people is destroyed, can it be rebuilt? And we have a wonderful poem by another modern Hebrew author, a certain man by the name of Mr. Frischman, who has a very poignant scene of the Messiah chained to the throne of God, pulling at the chains because he wants to break away, go down to the world, and help mankind. And God's answer is that the Messiah is ready, will be ready to redeem only when the people below are ready to be redeemed.
Unfortunately, I've never visited Israel, and it's my hope to do so. But I'm wondering...
You can get a passport by applying to the consulate.
I'll see Mr. Lurie after
the program. I'll see you any day.
I'm wondering, now that Herzl is buried in Israel, will the shrine... Will Herzl's burying place become a shrine for an optimistic outlook, say, on a day of Tisha B'Av, to visit the Herzl tomb, as well as to visit other places? That would seem to me inspire.
Mr. Lurie.
Well, I don't know whether it is likely to develop in that way, but it did occur to me as we were reading, as we heard the reading of this passage from Kings, that quite apart from the religious aspect, there are very interesting historical and geographical angles. We read there that the famine, and I'm quoting now, the famine that prevailed in the city, and there was no bread for the people of the land. And now we find that just this same thing happened only 2 years ago. I remember I was up in Jerusalem on July 7th, just during the truce, 2 days before the fighting resumed. And this sense of famine and isolation was entirely reflected in the story of Second Kings that we've been reading here. There's, of course, also, I think, a geographical aspect. And I think anyone who has been to Israel can visualize the King Tzidkiyahu escaping down the tortuous road to the Jordan Valley.
Well, what is significant really is that we can take an ancient day or a day which recalls an ancient experience and find again and again something which speaks to our own time and to our own hearts.
You have just heard a special Tisha B'Av program in the Eternal Light summer series, The Words We Live By. Our moderator was Professor Judah Golden, and our panelist was Professor Abraham Halkin. Our special guests today were Cantor Robert Siegel and the Distinguished Consul General of Israel in New York, the Honorable Arthur Lurie. Be with us again next week when we'll discuss the important question raised by the seventh chapter of Amos, Prophet, what do you see? Comments from the listeners will be appreciated. Our guest next week will be Mr. Cord Meyer, Jr., Chairman of the Executive Committee of United World Federalists, Incorporated. Free time to present The Words We Live By is made available by the National Broadcasting Company and its affiliated independent stations. This weekly transcribed program is presented under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America.
Motorists expect the unexpected from children. The National Safety Council asks you to consider every youngster walking or playing near the street a warning signal. And parents, you must share the responsibility for the tragic loss of child life. Every parent should consider early training in child rearing. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.